So I'm going to call this meeting to order. This is the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for March 2nd, 2017. And what are we going to do today, Sean?
Certainly, Chair Riley, members of the committee. We have a very straightforward agenda today. We have an informational meeting with three primary items. First up is the Judicial Branch Information Technology Overview. The primary agency in the Judicial Branch is the Oregon Judicial Department. They'll be giving us that overview. We'll then move to the Legislative Branch. We have the Chief Information Officer for the Legislative Administration here with us. And then finally, we'll move back to an Office of the State CIO Information Resource Management Plan presentation. Today we'll be focusing on the Administration and Business Services program area. So first up, we have Judicial Department, and so if you could come forward, and please remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Clem is on his way. He'll be a few minutes late.
Okay,
so can we just recognize that he's excused for
yes.
a few minutes?
Yes. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bryant Baer. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Judicial Branch, and it's my pleasure to present to you today our technology overview of the branch. Okay, we're not moving forward here.
There you go. Maybe to get things started, you might leave your cursor there and
there we go.
Okay. Sorry. And now you should be able to move it out of the
Thanks,
way.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah.
Hopefully. So this is just as you see, the brief of the branches of government. The judicial branch not only encompasses the judicial branch itself, but it also encompasses the Office of Public Defense and also the Commission on Judicial Fitness. As we talk about courts at our core, you can see from the slide here that we deal with a diverse set of circumstances. Everything from crimes and violations to children at risk, to civil and economic disputes and abuse and domestic relations issues as they go through the courts from start to resolution. And I think this is a good example of we have a lot of things that we work our way through, or that people depend on the courts to work their way through. The Oregon Judicial Department is structured as the following way. It's 7 Supreme Court justices, 13 judges on the Court of Appeals, 1 tax court judge and 3 magistrates, and 173 independently elected judges throughout the state. So I work for the Office of the State Court Administrator, who's currently the State Court Administrator is Kingsley Click, and my department is the Enterprise Technology and Services Department, or division, and that encompasses a number of different things. It encompasses how we maintain servers. It encompasses how we information security. We have a help desk. We do some project management. We have the Oregon eCourt program support process. We handle our phone system, and we also handle various different programs that we have accumulated over time. From a coding perspective, from an integration perspective, and I'll spend a little bit of time on integrations further on, because that's where you get into the fun part of data sharing. But we also do the Microsoft BizTalk integration items in my department as well. So from a statewide perspective, what do we support? The Appellate Court Management System, ACMS, is a product we purchased from LT Cortec or Thomson Reuters. It was a commercial off-the-shelf product that we spent a little bit of time making sure that it worked for the Oregon as it relates to laws, policies, and procedures. And then we went with Tyler Technologies as it relates to the Odyssey system for the circuit courts and for the tax court. So what does that do? What does that do for us? Well, it's our internal case management system for both sets of courts, and it also facilitates our public access components to it. There's a slide here we'll talk about what that means, but we basically took two programs, commercial off the shelf, and applied them to our two different courts. Court-specific, LT Cortec generally is in the appellate courts throughout the nation, and Odyssey is generally in the circuit courts. For example, Washington State is now using the Odyssey system. California is primarily using Odyssey. Idaho, Minnesota, Illinois, and most of Florida. And so what we ended up doing is not building it in-house, because as you've probably heard over time, there's a lot of overhead with that. We ended up going with the vendors to do it with products that have been proven throughout the country for our appellate courts and for our state court or circuit courts. My system, my department also supports the statewide infrastructure, which is our servers and our networks. Our email system, we support that. Our web presence, courts.oregon.gov. We have a robust web presence out there for information from everything from where the courts are to information you may need to access the courts. We have our legacy systems, and part of the eCourt program was to replace our legacy systems. So we have our OGIN and our FIOS. OGIN was started in 1984 on our COBOL-based system. We no longer are on a COBOL-based system. You can't really find people who know how to program COBOL much anymore. But it's one of those programs that's tried and true. The IBM systems were just bulletproof. And so it lived its life, and now we're on our more Microsoft platform. Our FIOS system, and so what we ended up doing when we replaced the ACMS system and we replaced the OGIN system, we archived all that information just to make sure that you never know when you're going to need it. So all that system is now archived and maintained by a team just to make sure we have all that historical information. Excuse me. Our integrations, as I have a slide here we'll talk about, that's how we share and receive data from our partners, from everything from the Secretary of State to ODOT to DHS and a number of different folks, how we share and receive information throughout the state. Information security, we have a team there, CISSP, CISA, all the neat acronyms for information security that monitor our systems statewide and also help us develop policies and procedures and training as it relates to information security statewide. And then we do video and remote services. And one of the neat things that we've been able to do is expand our video network statewide. So in-custody arraignments, for example, happen generally every day in every judicial district. Instead of having to take the folks in the jail, you hook them up, transport them to the courthouse, and then have them arraigned and transport back, they're done on video. They're done by video now. So the folks stay in the jail and are appearing before judges via video, and that saves a tremendous amount of time, energy, and effort on the sheriff's office's side of things. And so we've been able to expand and make sure it's robust enough to handle all of our video arraignments. Also, post-conviction relief. Folks that are sitting in jail that want to be in front of a judge regarding a post-conviction issue, now that's done by video instead of them being transported to a local courthouse or not. So much more efficient on how we're able to interact with folks using the latest technology. Language interpreter as well. We have systems set up to better interact via video and audio for folks who have English as a second language. So what do we spend on this? For my department, my general fund allocation is $19.1 million. That includes operations, technology purchases, and hardware and software maintenance. $5.5 million is other funds. That also includes supporting our online systems and public-facing systems and some hardware and software purchases for those. As you know, there's a difference between putting up systems that only support intra systems versus extra systems or extranet systems. So my total spending is $24.6 million. 66% of that is on personnel services, and 34% is on services and supplies. So I'm a total of 4.19% of OJD's total budget. So the Oregon eCourt program, again, replaced the systems for the appellate court system and for the circuit court system and tax. And so I like to put this up there because there's a lot of green check marks. And the neat thing, and I think Representative Nathanson would remember when we were in Lane County talking about the Odyssey system, we implemented on time and under budget. So very proud to report that to the legislature. But it does a number of different things for us. When I mentioned OGIN on a COBOL system was a case register system, meaning it looked at one case and documented the events that happened in that case. We ended up procuring a robust case management system, which includes document management, online activities, being able to look at people holistically through the court. And the example I like to give is if I'm coming in to pay a ticket, and if I have a warrant outstanding in another court, under the OGIN system, that court may not have known it. I could have a warrant in Washington County, but I'm paying my ticket in Clatsop County. Clatsop would not know. Now Clatsop knows. And generally Clatsop will say, the computer's running a little bit slow today. Why don't you just sit down for a minute, and I'll call you when we're ready. And then the sheriff's office shows up and takes charge from there. So I hope I didn't let the cat out of the bag. If that happens to you, our computers generally don't go down, so I would wonder. So anyways, we went from a case register system to a robust case management system, which did two things for us. One, it gave us the opportunity to change our business platform internally, but also to provide services externally to folks that were expecting these things. We pay bills online. We do that now. E-filing, we do that now, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But I just wanted to give you the dynamic of when the legislature says we're prepared to invest money and OJD says we're prepared to spend it, we wanted to make sure we were spending it in a way that had a dual purpose to it, increased our efficiencies internally, increased our ability to provide the public what they wanted externally. Another just very brief example of that is when somebody would file a case in paper, it could take time to get to the judge. It could take time if somebody else wanted to see it statewide, faxing, emailing. Now when it's scanned into the system, internally it's available within 3 minutes. Externally, if it's publicly available, it's available in 5 minutes. So when the court says, I accept that document, it's externally available within 5 minutes to the public, if it's a public document. So those are just some pretty neat things about when we looked at what we wanted, what the robustness side of things. So let's talk about that for a second. E-pay, you can pay online. Fines, fees, or assessments, or if you have an account, roughly 34% of what fines, fees, or assessments are paid online now or electronically. File and serve. In the last year, we accepted one. Oh.
Yes, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. From the interests expressed from a different subcommittee who works on financial information, not necessarily from an IT perspective, one of the things that's come to the legislature's attention is the contracts that are made between a state agency and a credit card company, and is it are we getting a good deal or not such a good deal, and how much revenue is diverted then for handling the transaction? So it would be interesting if you could let us know what kind of contract you have and if it's bundled with any other agencies so that you get a better deal by volume.
Happy to do that. Co-chairs. Happy to do that. We went through the state treasury on that, so we didn't do anything outside of our own independent. And so we use Chase and U.S. Bank for that, but I'm happy to provide that info. I'll have the finance folks provide that for you.
A follow-up?
Sure.
Do you think that the ease of use, or just the convenience of being able to pay online has increased the rate of payment versus non-payment?
Co-chairs, I believe in our overall presentation that will happen on the 13th, 14th, and 15th, they do address some of that. My personal belief is yes. And the example I would use is I was a trial court administrator in Clatsop County for a number of years, and Highway 26 is a notorious place for speeding. And so what would happen is somebody would get a ticket and come in and say, I would like to pay this ticket, but we didn't have the ticket yet. It would take a week before the court could get the ticket, and then another week for the court to get that ticket in our system. Now when you get a ticket from the Oregon State Police, it's in our system that night, and you can pay the next morning. And so from just a purely analytical perspective, my belief is yes, it does encourage people to pay because it does provide the vehicle to pay much quicker and much more efficiently and on your own time versus having to go to the court, take time off, write a check, send it in, and those type of things. So I'm sure I can get the information for you, but my belief is the more available you make it to the person's own time, the more you're going to get.
So, again, using technology wisely ends up being a good idea for two or three different reasons. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Except you don't catch as many people who have warrants.
Well, now that they know if they're going to pay a ticket, and they say, just hold on, the computer's not working, co-chair. Co-chairs, that was a very it took us a minute to wrap ourselves around that because we weren't used to getting that data. But now that we have it, staff are much more in tune to. It actually comes up when somebody comes in to do something. It will say, you have a warrant. It comes up with a big W. Also, which was interesting, is if somebody comes into a court and wants to do something, it will say whether there is financial owed anywhere in the state through the court system. So instead of me just doing that singular transaction for my ticket, the clerk may say, oh, I can see you owe money in Washington County or Linn County. Let's talk about how we pay for that right now. And so, again, that's just the flexibility and the ability to know the information. Mm-hmm. The actual statistics behind it, I would have to defer to our finance department. But great. That's information we now have at our fingertips due to the system. So ePay, 34%. Some folks ask why that number is not a little bit bigger. Well, you generally don't post bond through ePay, so there's some money that comes through just generally outside of the ePay system. And so this is for citations, filing fees, those type of things that would come through versus posting a $50,000 bond to get out of jail or something like that would not come through this system. Oregon File and Serve, January to January, did 1.5 million e-filings. It's mandatory for bar members. It's available to all users through the guidance file system, but we're working our way through that, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. But it is mandatory for the attorneys in Oregon, and the nice thing about that is it's the availability. They can do that 24/7. They can do that on their time. The court still imposes a timeline. It must be here, must be filed by this date. But that date doesn't stop at 4:59:59. That date stops at 11:59:59 now. And so the other plus is we get that information electronically, not in paper coming across the counter again. So one of the neat things that we did through this process was, or one of the things I consider was one of the neater things, was the guidance file. So if you think of like a TurboTax, what it does is these things for small for family cases, small claims, FEDs, satisfaction of money awards, renewal of a FAPA, and also more we'll be working on here in the future. This is a guided process for. And are you married? How many kids do you have? What's your address? Where's your residency? It will walk you through a series of questions and then allow you to file that document electronically with the court. And so there's a number of benefits to that. One, the person does that on their time. They can set up the account and work through this over a series of days, not feeling maybe the pressure of being in a courthouse or in a family resource center. They can work on it at their own speed and save it as they go along. Two, the court gets that information electronically, but also gets it legibly electronically. My wife is famous for saying that she can't read what I write even after 19 years. But if I type it out, we do much better. Or she'll say, send me a text. And so if we get it digitally, that's much better for the court. And we also get it in less paper, or we get it with no paper coming through. So right now, as I said, we can do family cases, divorce, separation, custody, parenting time, and you can file and respond to that, which is just a pretty neat option for the public out there for those that want to do this. We also offer our OJSON, which is our information online, which is our register of actions, court calendars, and court information. Attorneys have access to this, public safety, human services agency, and private sector. We also offer a free register of actions to the public. If you go to courts.oregon.gov and say do a search, you can put in a person's name, and it will give you some basic details if there is a case there to then the person can determine whether they need to dig in further or not. Documents, however, are available via subscription, and those are available to the attorneys, public safety, private sector, news media, data brokers, those type of things. So I know other folks have talked to you about what they're looking for in the next this legislative session. We have a policy option, or we have a policy option package 404 for the technology side of things. And what this package does is it funds software and licensing and system maintenance costs. It ensures our viability and response time to system to new systems. For example, California is investing in the Odyssey system, Idaho, Washington. We want to be able to be on the front end of taking advantage of those investments that they're making versus being behind on that. Provide statewide consistency and efficiency, e-filing, e-forms. You know, when the attorneys interact between multiple courts, they like interacting in a common platform. Versus different platforms, meaning consistency as it relates to accepting filings, those type of things. So we want to make sure we're putting energy into that. Staff training, efficiencies from centralized accounting. Now that we have this ability to look at the person holistically, our central accounting folks have really taken off on how do we take somebody who owes debt in a number of different courts, compiling that into a single payment, and then working with that person to pay that debt down versus each court trying to work with that person for their debt, which makes it more efficient for the person and more efficient for us. And we want to make sure that we're aptly capable of responding to law changes in our new electronic environments for both the appellate system and the circuit court system. So this just gives you a little bit of an example of the e-filing case access. We do provide, or the State Technology Services Fund pays for transactions fees for e-filings right now. Folks who file electronically do not pay a convenience fee for that. That is a zero fee. There are some fines or fees and assessments that go in basically for the filing, but you don't pay a separate fee for the e-filing itself. We do provide free access to court calendars and to a base register of actions. Free access is provided to government users, those that generally don't pay for things at the court, you know, DA's offices, DOC, DHS, those type of folks. They don't pay for the court access to the system. They're provided with documents. Indigent defense attorneys don't pay for document access and all that. And then we also have the interview-based forms, which we want to continue to expand upon, because as folks want to interact with the court, we want to do it with their ability, for their own intellectual ability to do that. Business process and training functions. We want to continue to establish statewide business processes to ensure consistency, improve data and reporting, and also just develop our own internal efficiencies to it. We want to make sure we're conforming with the law, of course, and provide training and peer network opportunities, because we learn and grow as a department as we go through this. Help desk, we have a robust help desk that we want to maintain for internal and external users. We have testing and periodic patch deploys in which we need to do, and then we just perform our general maintenance on our systems. We have a very, you knock on whatever synthetic wood you have in front of you, of a very high system availability, low system downtime, and we have teams that really make sure that that's there. And for those who are used to the computer side of things, uptime is everything. When you go in there and you can't get it, people get pretty frustrated pretty quick. And then again, we want to make sure that we're maximizing our use of our central accounting to take folks who have that debt out there from numerous different places and get them on a structured payment plan so they can relieve their debts with the court. As I come to the last couple of slides here, 24/7 availability to file pleadings and access court calendars and documents. Again, increased consistency and intelligent forms are also available 24 hours. Integrations, which will be my next slide to give you an idea how we transmit data back and forth with OJD. We have a lot of people who like our data and want our data, and we have data out there that we would like as well. And so you have to make sure you do that in a secure, well-monitored way, and so we have the teams to do that. And then we actually, with the person-based system, it makes it much easier to interact with folks versus individual court-to-court. So for the public, what did the public get? Well, they got a more efficient and effective court system. You can make the ability to make payments and e-filing. Enhanced security, we wanted to make sure that the information we have is maintained in the most secure function, in the most secure way. Folks have to file a supplemental confidential form that maintains information as it relates to Social Security numbers, dates of birth, if that's required. We keep that segregated so it's not out there to the public. Self-guided forms and e-filing, make sure those are done in a secure way. And online access to court calendars and basic case searches is one of the things that folks have really enjoyed. This is my neat slide. This gives you an idea of all the information that we share with the different agencies. As you can see, we've got Department of Human Services, Secretary of State, DMV, DAS, Oregon State Bar. And this gives you an idea just through our systems. And this chart seems to grow about every 2 weeks, because somebody else realizes either I have data that they want, or they have data that might be helpful to us. And so we want to make sure that our teams are doing this in a very thoughtful way, because once the court is entrusted with the data, we want to make sure that if we're sharing it, it's appropriate to share, or if we're receiving it, it's appropriate to receive it and how we store that. And so this just gives you an idea of some of the integrations that we have, and my belief that this is where we're going. In a very data-driven society, you know, when you Google something, say, I'm looking for tents, camping tents, and then you go to Facebook, it's amazing that the ad comes up for camping tents on your Facebook page. That's the data sharing things. Now, I'm not exactly excited about that, but in our situation here, we want to make sure that we're sharing the appropriate data and receiving the appropriate data. And so in summary, co-chairs and members of the committee, for my summary, we want to make sure that we have a stable enterprise system with a failover capability. We do have our failover capability now. We're very excited about that. It has been tested. Diligent monitoring of our enterprise network and data systems, including information security. We did the successful deployment of the Oregon E-Corp program. We want to make sure that we're investing our energy, time, and resources to maximize the investment that the legislature gave to us and that we spent. And then we want to make sure that we're supporting our infrastructure. Interestingly enough, we have 68 sites in which we support our infrastructure at. 27 judicial districts, 36 counties, but we also go into various different jails, facilities, correctional facilities for our video and all that. So we want to make sure that we're putting our investment where it needs to be and providing the efficiencies that we can. So for your consideration, co-chairs, members of the committee, that is a brief overview of the Oregon Technology Department.
Questions? Yes, Representative Ehrman.
Thank you, Chair Riley. So I know when you had the eCourt software project, that when it started off, it was a little rocky, but then the way I understand it was that when you adopted this latest iteration of it, that part of the guiding principle was that you weren't going to gather requirements from the stakeholders. You were going to just take this software and just put it on them and tell them to change their operations to fit the software rather than to try to customize a solution around them. And I bring this up because I'm interested in that as a model for other agencies. But maybe you can talk about that, because you're past the finish line now. Did that work, or do you have, in hindsight, do you have customization that you need to do to clean up, to keep people happy or to keep people useful or whatever? Or just take it as kind of a free jump off the thing and talk about that.
Co-chairs, Representative, I don't remember any rocky start to the Oregon E-Corp program at all. Sorry. What you're referring to is we would not customize unless required by the law. Mm-hmm. And we still stick by that. We have in one situation, I believe, required a small bit of custom code, but that was it. And the reason that is you can't take advantage of overall consistency and efficiencies if courts or other divisions get to kind of do their own thing. And so we had one small space, I think, as it relates to a data migration, that we had to do some customized code to make sure the data migrated over appropriately, but we did not customize unless we had to, as required by law. And I have to admit, I have that poster still in my office, and I still reference that quite a bit, because people are saying, well, now that you're past it, can we just do this or can we do that? And my response is that required by the law? Because the second you go down a customized path, much like we did with OGEN was a completely customized program, but we needed to make sure that we had the staff on hand. We were stuck as it relates sometimes to the I-Series upgrades that we could do. So my response to that is, yes, we have still stuck to only customized as required by law, and we have not varied from that, except for when we needed to do some data migration. And I think that that's worked out very well for OJD. Was there some consternation in the start? Were there courts that says, no, we have to do this, we've done this? Our DA's office, our sheriff's office, our county manager requires this? And we would say, that's great, please just show us where that's required by the law. And if they couldn't do that, we said, here's the business process in which we're adopting. And once we got past that, the trial court administrators and judges came on board. And so I think that's one of the shining moments in this thing, is we maintain this. We're not going to customize, because we knew that would cost an awful lot and take us down a path that wasn't sustainable.
If I can just follow. So you're not such a big meanie after all, then, right? And I'll take even a step farther. I'll say, if you find a place where it conflicts with law, I'll give you an opportunity to come back to me. And that's part of my job, is to change the law. So I'll even throw that as a possibility out to you. But congratulations on your project there.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you.
So he may need a little help to do that. But Senator Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I went all the way back to the slide where you have the administrative structure. It's a very busy slide, and I'm wondering if you could speak to us a little bit about integration with DA offices and their information technology structure, even county sheriffs, municipal police departments, and all of those you know, you can aggregate your answer if you would like to, but I'm curious, if I were to go up to the fun slide you had with the green and blue, they're coming in, they're using, there's little bit of exchanges going on. You see the double arrows. Can you speak to that? How does that work? Is it just a great big question mark in my mind?
Co-chair, Senator, absolutely. I'm much more freer as it relates to the providing of data to systems, as long as we can do that statutorily, versus the acceptance of data. And the reason I do that is, as folks know, once data is corrupted in some way, shape, or form, it's difficult to put the chain to correct it. And so as it relates to the court, Oregon State Police is really our only true data integration right now. When they write a citation, we get the data elements that feeds into our system, creates the case. I have no other system, I have no other place where that does that, simply because I need the clerks or the courts to acknowledge what they're receiving and review it before we do that. So, for example, is I wouldn't allow a DA's office to auto-file and auto-create a case into our system, because I would need to make sure that a human being looked at that to make sure that it was accurate, that it was appropriate, because you wouldn't want an auto-arrest warrant issued in those type of situations. So we spend a lot of time making sure that the information we send out is accurate. The information we get in, generally from the Oregon State Police, we get information in from Department of Transportation, DMV, and also for Secretary of State for our jury pools, but we don't generally suck in a lot of case information except through the file and serve system, which is then adopted and acknowledged by the court clerk at the time. So we have some integration, the one integration that auto does things in our system. The rest come into our system through guide and file, through file and serve, or through some other means that are then reviewed by court staff prior to being accepted by the court. And so that was a very important step on our end. I'm not sure if that quite gets to your answer, but
it does. Thank you. Mm-hmm. It does, and it's not widespread integration is the crux of the answer.
Correct.
That's fine. I was just curious about how that worked.
No, and co-chairs and Senator, we will get to a point where the DA's offices will be able to, depending upon what software program they use, we're talking about standing up what we call an electronic filing service manager, which is a service bus between our system and a DA system where they could better interact electronically with us, but it would still go through that filter of our BizTalk environment. It would still go through the filter of a court clerk looking at that and then accepting it into the court versus it just auto-feeding in. And so that's what we're working on that right now. With the criminal justice agencies, with like the sheriff's offices, those generally go through a DA office, so that's where our primary focus is right now. DOC has access to information, but DOC cannot feed our system with anything because we want to make sure what we're getting is accurate and it's appropriate for us to have.
Follow up. Yes. And real quick, with regard to DOC, probation, parole, corrections, mm-hmm. all of those mm-hmm. things at the county level, mm-hmm. they're also not fully integrated other than as you just described.
Co-chairs, Senator, that's correct. We funnel most of our criminal type information through the district attorney's office. So that's where that would come from. Very rarely does the community corrections file something directly with the court, other than it might be a report or something like that. If there's a probation violation or something, that generally comes through the district attorney's office. That's why our primary focus right now as it relates to data exchanges is looking at the DA's offices and using that as the funnel through for that type of information.
Thank you very much. It's been very helpful. You're way ahead of the system that I wrote and put in for the Superior Court of California and COBOL. So thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you for your time.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, next up we have the CIO for the Legislative Administration. He'll be giving Legislative Branch Information Technology Overview. And Brett, if you could introduce yourself for the record prior to beginning your presentation.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Riley, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Brett Haynes, Chief Information Officer, Legislative Administration. I would like to take a little walk through the organization, and I'll talk about who we are as a team, our current state of things, some of our current challenges, where that's leading to our focus, and an overview of our strategy. We are split up into four different groups. Customer engagement team, these are the folks that I think you see on a daily basis. There are advisors that walk around, our project managers, and our trainers. So whenever there's a user training class or there's onboarding for your staff, they're the team that are forward-facing for you. We have our operations and security team, largest team in the group. They're the ones that keep the lights on, keep our systems running, keep our systems secure. They're our help desk and our desk side technicians whenever you have an issue with your printer or your wireless. Then we have our media services team. They are the ones making sure that the audio and video, everything's being recorded and streamed. They'll do productions on special request, the mobile hearings that we do, and any of the special events. And then finally, our design and
Senator Lincecum.
Thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I had a question about this slide. Can you give us FTEs in each of these four categories? You mentioned, for example, the largest team, and I'm just wondering how many individuals that is.
Chair Nathanson, Chair Riley, Senator Lincecum. Sure, I can. Actually, I'll jump to the appendix, and I can give you that total count. Total FTEs is right about 35 folks.
Okay.
And for the first time in a while, we have all of our positions filled. We have no open recruitments right now. And just to spend a moment here on the slide while I'm here, by design, most IT organizations have their biggest team in operations and security because, as I mentioned, they're the group that has to keep the lights on. Design and development, where your developers and architects sit, they typically scale based on the project load. But the more things that we put into our production environment, more that have to be supported by that operations team. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Okay. So our current state, to ground you to the slide, because I know there's a lot of information on there, the chart on the top right is our count of work orders, help desk tickets, in the 2013 session, the 2015 session, and our current session to date. And you'll notice a pretty significant drop from 2013 to now. In fact, the ticket volume's right at about half, and the amount of time we're spending on calls about our custom applications, which I'll speak to more in the next slide, is down by about 75%. And that tells me that our focus during the interim have been on the right things. We did almost 100 modifications to our custom applications, either break fix issues or small enhancements, to try to make the process a little more efficient. We did a number of infrastructure improvement projects and upgrades to some of our third-party products. We've put additional emphasis on training and engagement, trying to switch the model from being reactive to more proactive. And we are also looking at projects where we can digitize a lot of our paperwork. I know we have a lot of paper forms, a lot of good opportunity there to make the switch to digital. And then finally, doing some more enhancements to the user experience, trying to bring in new technologies that drive efficiency and productivity. I know bring your own device is a popular thing, so trying to introduce some things so you can print from your personal device and maybe use it to do more work, without having to. Those that love Apple, you don't have to stick with the Microsoft product. We're not all the way there. We've made a lot of improvements. I'm really proud of the team, but we're not there yet. So some of our existing challenges. I mentioned our custom applications. We have applications that help enable the legislative process, things that handle fiscal and revenue impact statements, staff measure summaries, the bill drafting system. These are all custom-built applications on various platforms. Some platforms, the bill drafting system, for example, is on an IBM mainframe. It's a custom-built app. It's been working for over 30 years. But the risk, at each successive year, becomes greater with the ability to support and resources on hand. Oracle Forms, for example, that some of our applications are built on, it's a technology Oracle's moving away from. And again, our availability of resource to support that are starting to dwindle. We use .NET for applications like OLIS. While that's a current and modern technology, the versions that we have are starting to fall behind. We can't keep pace with browser upgrades, operating system upgrades, because we are a relatively small team. And the cost of ownership for custom applications, while they can be very detailed in the requirements that they fulfill, they start to lag or require a lot of support and care and feeding. Maybe you like to use Google Chrome, or maybe you're a Firefox person, or Safari, or Internet Explorer. Trying to keep compatibility with all four of those browsers becomes very challenging to do. So what does all that mean? What are we going to do about it? So our current focus, as I mentioned before with the operations teams, we've got to keep the lights on. We have to keep the applications working. So any break fix issues that we encounter during session, we'll fix. Any requests for enhancements that don't require a complete re-architecture of the custom application is something we'll take a look at accomplishing during the interim. We also want to start taking a look at disaster recovery. Now, prior to my getting here, there was a POP that was approved. We're going to implement that. And that phase one for disaster recovery is cold site storage. And what I mean by that is we're going to take all of our production data, and we're going to put it somewhere safe. And should there ever be a disaster from something like losing the data center or a major catastrophe, we could recover that production data by losing no more than 24 hours worth of production information. I would like to do a follow-on with that to get to a solution similar to what I had implemented in my previous job back in Ohio, where we build out an environment that we use for our pre-production or QA environment that matches production and infrastructure. Still back up our production data to that site, but if we lose our data center here in Salem, we can spin up that environment, and all the applications and all the data that you had would then be available. Document publishing and management system. This is the cornerstone project for modernizing all of our custom applications. We're starting with the bill drafting system. We're going to just take the next year and gather requirements, work with legislative counsel, make sure that we're meeting the requirements and the capabilities of the customization of that first system, and then figure out what the right platform is going forward. And it's not going to, at start, we want to focus on bill drafting, but over the course of the project and successive phases, we want to make sure we have a truly integrated solution on a platform that has long-term supportability. And then finally, voice over internet protocol phone system. I know everybody's been talking about Project Music and when are we going to move over to it. They have taken a pause to fix some of the issues that they've experienced in their initial deployments. We're in touch with that team. We had originally talked about sometime in the interim after this session making that cutover. But depending on resolution of their issues and when they will remove that freeze, will then drive when we make that cutover. Finally, strategy. Strategy, what I'm trying to get to is setting a vision at a high level. And then I want, you know, there are imperatives to that vision, there are principles and initiatives. And every layer down gets more and more detailed down to the project level. We are looking to do innovative solutions and services. that's our goal, to enable the legislative process to make life easier for you and your staff and the supporting agencies in this building. We want to make sure our systems are resilient. That means they're secure and protected in case of a disaster. We want scalable solutions that can grow or shrink based on demand. We want an integrated solution, things that can work well together, so we don't have manual handoffs or opportunities for error. And enabling, you know, again, productivity and efficiency. And then that are supportable. My mandate to the team is if we pick a technology, you know, that we're going to stick with, it's got to be within two major releases of its most current version. Typically don't want to be on the bleeding edge of a new version of technology because it's inherently buggy. But one or two versions behind means you're well within the support life and you're following that production support stream. Principles. So to build on the imperatives, we want to make sure it's fit for purpose. It's the right tool for the right job. And they should be simple and elegant solutions. Nothing overly complicated. And reuse, buy, and build. So if we have something and it's working great and it's supportable and it meets all those imperatives, we'll keep it. If not, let's go out and buy something that's supportable, something that has a long shelf life to it. And if all else fails, then we can talk about customization. Controlled technical diversity. I'll give you an example even within information systems. We have three systems that we use to track requirements and development solutions. We're not that big. I'm not really sure why. So we're going to get rid of two of those. So fewer, less is more. Customer centricity. We should be partnering with everyone to find the right solutions to make sure it's accepted. Because by and large, at least in my experience, whenever you do a large change to a technology platform, if you listen to the requirements, if you partner with the team, you're going to get a lot better change acceptance. Because quite often the technology solution in and of itself may be relatively simple, but getting people to buy in on it takes that engagement, and I think that's why that's important. And then, of course, compliance with laws and regulations. So that's going to drive our initiatives. So modernizing our fleet, improving our infrastructure, improving our internal and external processes, the way we're engaged, the way we do work, the way we convert requests into projects, and then, of course, disaster recovery. So I know I ran through those slides pretty quick, so barring any questions you might have.
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chairman Riley. So thanks for your presentation and thanks for your work, too. I just want to say that I'm a customer on your OData API for legislative information stuff, and that thing works great. And as a customer, I like it, and as a legislator, I like the price tag of the open source factor of it. So thanks for implementing that. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, last up today, we'll have the Office of the State CIO. We'll have Heidi Zinsman, who serves as the Strategic Technology Officer for the Administration and Business Services Program Area. She'll be talking about that Program Area Information Resource Management Plan. And if you could remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Yes.
Before you start presenting.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Zinsman, Strategic Technology Officer for Administration and Business Services with the Office of the State CIO. With me today is Darren Wellington, Strategic Technology Officer for Public Safety, who will be running the slides on my behalf. Because as we have demonstrated, it does take two STOs to get through a PowerPoint presentation. Thank you for the opportunity today to present the Information Resource Management, or IRM, plan for the Administration and Business Services Policy Area. As with the other presentations that you've already seen, I will be covering some of the highlights from the document. The complete plan is included with your committee materials. First, I'd like to briefly acknowledge some of the contributors to the IRM plan, which was developed through collaboration with a variety of stakeholders, both within the agencies and with the Office of the State CIO. I would like to specifically thank the four chief information officers who were key contributors to the content, two of whom are in the audience today. And the next slide is just highlighting some of the guiding principles that influenced development of the IRM plan for this specific policy area. Specifically, the IRM plan will support the mission goals and priorities of the individual agencies within the program area, reflect the governor's vision for open and accessible and accountable government, align with the state CIO's enterprise information resource management strategy, and serve as a foundation for IT alignment. Since this is the first ever policy area IRM plan done, the majority of the document does pertain to current state information, reflecting existing IT operations and initiatives, and identifying opportunities for improvement moving forward. So this slide lists the agencies that for our office are included in the policy area. The largest four agencies include Department of Revenue, Department of Consumer and Business Services, Department of Administrative Services, and the Public Employees Retirement System. Others include the Governor's Office, Public Utilities Commission, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Construction Contractors Board, in addition to six smaller administrative boards also listed. Moving forward, I will refer to some of the agencies by their acronyms, if that's okay. I would like to note that although the Oregon State Lottery, Secretary of State, and Treasurer are also represented in this policy area, the IRM plan does not currently include content on these agencies as they are exempt from OSCIO oversight. As I mentioned, one section of the IRM plan is focused on providing an overview of the IT environment for the agencies in the policy area. The next few slides will cover a few highlights. The first topic is IT infrastructure. This table indicates which agencies are hosting their systems at the State Data Center, also referred to as SDC, and also the other SDC services that are used by those agencies. The four agencies managing most of the technology infrastructure are either hosting their systems at the State Data Center or actively planning to migrate. Specifically, data center migration planning for both DCBS and PERS is currently in progress. For DCBS, they are targeting their data center migration completion by the end of this calendar year. And for PERS, the initial focus for fiscal year 17 will be on providing critical disaster recovery services for the agency. The three smaller agencies listed, Public Utilities Commission, Construction Contractors Board, and BOLI, each currently maintain their server infrastructure at their agency's administrative offices. Most of the agencies also utilize the data center to manage wide area network services that provide connectivity between their facilities. Next slide. Regarding the IT workforce for these agencies, they really fall into three groups that I wanted to highlight. The largest four, Revenue, DCBS, DAS, and PERS, have central IT departments and chief information officer positions. There's the smaller agencies, PUC, Construction Contractors Board, and BOLI, with just a few IT resources, and then the governor's office and the small administrative boards with no IT resources. So the agencies that do have IT resources, they face some common staffing challenges, and I don't think this is just within this policy area, probably across the state. These were the few that we wanted to highlight. Attracting and retaining IT expertise and diverse workforce needed to meet growing business needs. And then also balancing having sufficient resources to both deliver new IT solutions in addition to supporting legacy and mainframe applications. Just as an example, Department of Administrative Services has limited staff resources with the skills, COBOL programming, et cetera, to maintain some of the critical enterprise mainframe applications that are used by most state agencies. These same resources are required to help transition to the new solutions. The agencies that do not have IT staff typically contract with third-party providers. This does present some opportunities for enterprise and shared services to meet those common business needs, and also some challenges maintaining and securing the solutions managed by these organizations. Let's see on that one. Next topic is IT governance. You have heard my colleagues discuss the importance of formal IT governance practices for managing the evaluation, prioritization, and resource allocation for competing technology investments. This is one of the key areas our office will be working on with agencies moving forward. To be effective, IT governance requires IT leadership participation in the agency's strategic planning. And in addition, a formal IT strategic plan supports governance by guiding the investment decisions. So the governance maturity within this policy area varies. Just to highlight a few examples, both PERS and Department of Revenue have formally documented IT strategic plans. PERS, Revenue, and DCBS each utilize established IT governance committees, but have identified specific improvements as a priority for 17-19 biennium. DCBS and DAS do not currently have formal IT strategic plans. However, the CIOs for these agencies are committed to making strategic planning a priority moving forward. DAS has established a central IT department in 2016 and recently initiated an advisory committee to support governance processes for the agency. The smaller agencies, appropriately, have less formal methods for review and approval of IT initiatives. That's on that one. And lastly, security continues to be a focus for the agencies within the policy area and across the state, as agencies are supporting existing services and implementing new IT projects for which meeting security requirements is critical to addressing data protection and compliance mandates. Most of the agencies do lack sufficient IT security resources to support these needs. Several of the agencies listed here have completed or are in the process of completing external risk assessments. The Construction Contractors Board recently engaged an information security consultant to complete a comprehensive risk assessment following a recent security breach. The Public Employees Retirement System is currently executing an information security enhancements project. They are working with a security consultant and with the Enterprise Security Office to complete planning for a more formal cybersecurity program, as well as addressing some specific security priorities. Department of Revenue and DCBS were both included in the recent Secretary of State security audit. And finally, as part of the governor's executive order unifying cybersecurity in Oregon, additional assessments are being completed to provide a baseline of the state's risk profile across all agencies and information assets. DAS, DCBS, and Department of Revenue are each included in the initial risk assessments. So the next couple slides shift from current state to future state and highlight the IT strategic goals and objectives that were identified in the IRM plan. The IT leadership agreed to four strategic goals for the 17-19 biennium. The first strategic goal is customer focus. Improve access to state services with a focus on customer priorities and improving the customer experience. I'd like to elaborate on this one just briefly, and I won't do so for the others. Just within this context, that when we talk about customers for state agencies, this could include citizens, consumers, businesses, employees, and in the case of DAS, other state agencies, just as examples. Customer experiences with the private sector are really changing the expectation for government agencies. Examples include providing access to services featuring easy-to-use and frequently updated web and mobile applications, using customer-specific information, and providing self-service options. Focusing on these requirements can provide key opportunities for shared services, as agencies must work together to deliver services from a customer perspective. The second strategic goal is sustainability. This is becoming more of a focus as agencies are having to modernize their systems. The strategic goal is to modernize critical state systems or functions and IT services that using technologies and approaches that provide for increased business agility, maintainability, and ongoing compliance. The third goal is enterprise focus. Increase use of shared and enterprise IT services to eliminate redundancy and achieve business efficiencies. The fourth supporting goal listed here is really aimed at the continued maturity of the IT organization, IT strategy and governance. Mature IT strategic planning and governance to support critical modernization efforts and improve enterprise alignment within each agency and across the policy area. So this slide shows that in support of the shared strategic goals, which are listed in the columns, the IT leadership identified 7 specific objectives for 17-19. The first 2 are related: support cross-agency partnerships for shared services and explore partnerships for IT resource sharing and project support. An example would be partnering some of the larger agencies with small agencies, especially in the case where the small agencies may not have those capabilities. The third objective is to increase cross-agency involvement with the major transformation projects to encourage collaboration on modernization strategies. Objective number 4 is to support the IT security unification and promote a community focus on security. The 5th objective is to migrate services to the state data center to address infrastructure and disaster recovery priorities. Objective 6 is strategic plan development. As I mentioned previously, both the DAS and DCBS CIOs have identified a need to develop strategic plans to support agency IT governance. And lastly, collaborate on IT governance improvements. Since each of the larger agencies plan to focus on improvements with their leadership teams, the CIOs have agreed to meet regularly to collaborate on IT governance challenges, strategies, and successes. And the last topic is IT projects. So within this program area, there are a lot of projects. There's approximately 30 current or planned projects that are highlighted in the IRM plan itself. Just a few of the major projects are listed here with an indication of the alignment with the 3 primary strategic goals. Just a few examples to highlight. Most of the projects are aligned with the strategic goal for sustainability as agencies pursue various options for improving the agility and maintainability of major systems through the delivery of the new solutions. Examples would include the DAS Human Resources Information Project and the Department of Revenue Core System Replacement Project. Just as an example, the core system replacement is in its final phase of implementation, I think in its 4th year, and they have not made any customizations yet to the system that was transferred. Another example, I think, of moving a system from another state and making it successful in Oregon. Many of the projects plan to improve the customer experience, providing features such as improved ease of use, secure data access, and self-service. And regarding enterprise and shared services, there are several projects, again including the DAS Human Resources Information System, that are modernizing an enterprise service used by all state agencies. As mentioned previously, both DCBS and PERS also have data center migration projects plan to take advantage of enterprise infrastructure and disaster recovery services provided by the state data center. There are a couple of shared service projects in this policy area involving licensing system upgrades. The first one that's listed there, we have 5 small boards in this policy area: the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners, the Board of Architect Examiners, and the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, joined with 2 health boards to implement a new licensing system, which is hosted at the State Data Center. And lastly, DCBS and the Construction Contractors Board are partnering on a licensing system upgrade based on their shared customers and business processes. In conclusion, the agencies in this area do share many challenges and opportunities related to information and technology management. This IRM plan does provide a foundation for ongoing engagement between the Office of the State CIO Strategic Technology Office and the policy area IT leadership, as well as an increased focus on shared strategies and objectives to meet common business needs. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Chair Riley. So I like the cooperation on the licensing there. So you just have one sphere of that you're responsible for there. And it occurs to me that there's a lot of other licensing agencies, like health in the healthcare little circle, there's a bunch of them. Do you ever go out of your own zone and cooperate with those folks? Or?
Yes, co-chairs, Representative Nierman. And in that particular case, it does happen to be 2 health boards and 3 administrative boards. And as was discussed yesterday, they were really picking up on a previously successful implementation by the Health Licensing Organization. Mm-hmm. But I believe it was Ben Tate for Education that mentioned that the STOs, the six of us, collaborate on all of these things. And obviously, a lot of these opportunities are not shared service opportunities just within one program area. Mm-hmm. They really are common business needs across the enterprise. So, yes, there are a number of those opportunities coming up around licensing. And I think it's just at the beginning, but we will be collaborating and looking for opportunities within Basecamp to further evolve those options.
Good. Thanks. Can I ask another question?
Yes, Paul.
Thanks. No, it's not really a follow-up. It's a different one. So I think on slide five, on slide five, you have all these agencies that are either done migrating or in the middle of migrating to the state data center there. Are there any opportunities for them to migrate to third-party cloud systems, or how come I don't see that in the chart here?
Yes, co-chairs, Representative Nierman, thank you for the question. That is definitely an option as well. So the model moving forward is for the agencies to work with Enterprise Technology Services, who operates the state data center, mm-hmm. and really take advantage of either their services that they can offer at the data center, if appropriate, for a specific, let's say, a specific application hosting need, or if appropriate, broker those services with other providers. That would be the objective. And in some cases, that may be the best opportunity for an individual agency.
May I follow? So with PERS, so that seems to be kind of cookie cutter data. It's not special data or anything like that. Was that ever considered with PERS, or it seems like they're right at the beginning of making those kinds of decisions right now?
Yes, co-chairs, Representative Nierman, thank you. It is kind of right at that front end of planning, and there is a policy option package. The planning that was done just to create estimates for the POP basically took the worst-case scenario, but it leaves open any of those potential, because there is some more work to do to complete that planning as far as where the location would be.
Good, thanks.
If that makes sense.
All right, thank you very much. And we appreciate you coming to fill us in.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, just wanted to provide a couple of points of clarification. Representative Nierman, you asked the question about consideration of cloud services providers. Just want to make sure the committee is aware that currently the Office of the State CIO, through its Enterprise Technology Services office or unit, does hold a contract with a Portland provider. I think that was mentioned at one of our previous meetings. It's currently called Atmosphera. It used to be called Easy Street in the Portland area. That's mm-hmm. the primary provider. Certainly as part of the Basecamp initiative, taking advantage of some regional or national contracts through the National Association of State Procurement Officers and their program called ValuePoint, there is a nationwide cloud services contract that certainly the state of Oregon is eligible to participate in, and I know in talking with the Office of the State CIO, that's something they're considering on a strategic basis where it makes sense. The second point, Ms. Zinsman indicated in one of her slides that in 2016, a centralized IT, I think a term that was used is department, it's actually the Office of the State CIO, was formally created with the State Data Center as part of its portfolio in 2016. Want to make sure you all are aware that currently that office does reside within the Department of Administrative Services, and that's really the topic that we're considering with now Senate Bill 872 this body just voted to introduce. Previously the legislative concept number was 2131. So currently the Office of the State CIO is housed inside of DAS. It does have enterprise IT responsibility, but it is not currently a separate department. So anyway, I want to make sure you're aware of that.
Thank you.
Lastly, I'm sorry, Senator Riley.
Okay.
It was mentioned that the Oregon State Lottery, the Secretary of State, and the Treasurer are not subject to the Office of the State CIO's oversight, and that is correct. However, in 2015, House Bill 3099, which created that enterprise capability and or responsibility inside the Office of the State CIO, also dealt with the issue of the alignment of plans, policies, and approaches for information technology and for information security within the Secretary of State and the Treasurer. They are required by law to, although they are separate from the Office of State CIO, they do need to coordinate with the Office of State CIO and ensure that there is alignment of their plans, policies, and procedures, and they're required to provide that information to the Legislative Fiscal Office on your behalf. So there is some approach or method for alignment, even though they're not required to be part of this planning effort on a mandatory basis.
Can you repeat the House bill and year?
Sure. So House Bill 3099 okay. was passed in 2015. And that's the primary statute that, again, clarified that the state CIO is an appointee of the governor, should receive direction from the governor. It also placed all enterprise IT service responsibility with the state CIO. However, it did not break apart the Department of Administrative Services and the Office of the State CIO. It instead housed the Office of the State CIO inside of DAS.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that does it for today.
It does.
If no one has anything for the good of the order, we are adjourned.